Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
The New York Times has just started an ongoing feature called Overlooked, obituaries for women whose deaths should have been covered by the Times but weren't. To discuss, we're joined now by Jessica Bennett, an award-winning journalist and author, and the first ever gender editor of the New York Times. Good evening, Jessica.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
So tell me how this project came about.
So the project came about originally with a young female editor in our obituary section who had started collecting names that she would stumble upon of women that never received obituaries in the New York Times. And turns out there were a lot of these women. Once we finally began pulling the data, and we actually looked back at our pages all the way back to 1851 for 167 years, we realized that, in fact, almost 80% of the obituaries that have been published in the New York Times since then have been of men, many of them white men. And so we started searching in our archives. We spent a lot of time digging through old stories and trying to find the women who had been overlooked.
Is there a particular reason why they weren't covered that you could find, or is it just kind of the general feeling at the time? Because I saw where Charlotte Bronte, her husband got an obit, but she didn't.
Right. I mean, the names are fascinating. There's no real comprehensive way of finding these women. So some of them I would search and look up historic names throughout history and see if they had one. So that's how we found out that Ida B. Wells had never had an obituary, though her wedding was actually on the front page of the paper. She, of course, was the suffragist and journalist who was a leading voice of the anti-lynching movement. But others like Charlotte Bronte never received one. Sylvia Plath never received an obituary. And in Bronte's case, it was hilarious because the day that we published this project, somebody sent us a clipping of her husband's death. And the husband's death, the headline of the obituary said, Charlotte Bronte's husband dies. And yet she herself never received an obituary. So there wasn't any real reason why we should do it now. It was Women's History Month. We launched on International Women's Day, and so we wanted to highlight the project. But, you know, I think that this reflects sexism of the era. This reflects the fact that obituaries memorialize a life, and women's lives for many, many years have not been valued with the same way.
In doing the research with Amisha Pednani, how often did you say, wow, or just we're awestruck in general?
I mean, pretty often, and we've put out a call, and we should put it out to your listeners as well. We're asking people to send us names of those we have missed, and we've already received more than 1,500 submissions. And these can be women, they can also be men. The idea with this project is that we started with women, but we will expand the lens beyond women as we go forward and continue it indefinitely as a regular column in our obituary section. But we were shocked a lot of the time, and other times it was almost funny to read the language used to describe the women who, in fact, did receive obituaries. So a couple of examples. Frida Kahlo, when she died in 1953, her obituary described her first as the wife of Diego Rivera, and then later on in the second paragraph as a painter in her own right. Susan B. Anthony, the suffragist. The obituary writer at the time chose to describe her accomplishments, of course, but also describe that she had a very nice figure and face. And so in many of these cases, just reading the language was so indicative and telling of the time.
That's shocking to me. And you brought up Sylvia Plath. Like, the bell jar is such a cultural touchstone for so many people. And the fact that she was overlooked is just shocking to me.
Yeah, it's pretty surprising. And, you know, how did we make these mistakes? How did we overlook these women? Well, I think the reality is that during these times, it was largely men and largely white men making the decisions. And that wasn't exclusive to the New York Times. But one thing that we wanted to do with this project was be really transparent about the gaps and about the fact that, you know, we are accepting responsibility for the fact that we overlook these women and are now trying to correct the record.
In going through and doing all this research, did you see that things were starting to get better? We tend to think of, you know, sexual liberation, the women's lib movement in the 60s and 70s, but were there more obits showing up, like, starting then?
So it was really hard to do the research, in part because the way that obituaries are written has changed so much. So back in the early days of publishing, when the New York Times began publishing in 1851, most obituaries were just one sentence or two, and they hardly had any information. But then at a certain point, paid death notices were also introduced, and those are the ones where a family member can pay to actually write the words of the obituary and have it be published in the New York Times. So we tried to exclude those from this process because we wanted to show the ones specifically where we had made an editorial judgment. But we had to sift back through thousands and thousands of archives. We had to pull all of these books of indexes so that we could find out what was published. We had to do analyses by name and looking at modifiers like Ms. or Mrs. And at a certain point, we realized that, in fact, we've been searching all of these women's names, but until the late 1970s, if you're a woman who died, your name actually appeared under your husband's name. So you were Mrs. husband's name. So then we had to go back and redo all of that research. So we don't have very specific numbers for a lot of these periods, and there's certainly a margin of error. We do know that it got a bit better over time, but it's still not good enough.
Wow. It seems with the recent Me Too movement and more women telling their stories of sexual harassment that we've kind of reached a turning point. This is something that you've explored an awful lot in your writing. Just how much farther is there to go?
I mean, I think there's a lot farther to go. This is a new job for me. I began this role as gender editor at the New York Times 2 weeks after the Harvey Weinstein story broke. So I've been sort of up to my eyeballs in it. But I think one of the things that's encouraging is that we're seeing the conversation move, I think, from man after man who's been fired or fallen or exposed to how do we look at institutions, how do we look at the complicity within organizations, and how do we actually fix the problem? Are there ways that we can deal with this on a policy level? Are there ways that we can deal with it on an HR level? But sort of shifting the conversation from the problem to solutions.
Do you think that starts maybe in the ways that we disseminate media in this country? I mean, you look at newsrooms nationwide, this is a problem that's, you know, touched NPR, LA Times, and New York Times itself.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think that's certainly a component of it. You know, many people have made the point that a lot of these men were really shaping the way that we consume culture and the way that we essentially create cultural narratives. And so the fact that many of these men who are on television every day and running film industries and writing for the pages of the most powerful newspapers turn out to be predators in some sense is very disconcerting. And so when you think about something like the Overlooked Project, no, this wasn't a direct outcome of the Me Too movement. But if there were more women in positions of power at the New York Times and other outlets, we probably wouldn't be having to be correcting right now.
Jessica Bennett is the gender editor at the New York Times and is the author of the best-selling book, Feminist Fight Club, A Survival Manual for a Sexist Workplace. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Spring is a time of renewal, so why not refresh your home with a little help from Blinds.com? We make getting custom window treatments a minor project with major impact. Choose from premium blinds, shades, and shutters. We even have options for your patio, too. Blinds.com invented a better way to shop for custom window treatments. There's no pushy salespeople in your home or inflated showroom prices. Our design experts can help you find the perfect window treatments on your schedule. We'll even send free samples directly to you. Plus, we can handle the measuring and installation for you. Unlimited window treatments installed for just one low cost. And with Blinds.com, you'll always get transparent pricing. No hidden fees. Our free shipping and 100% satisfaction guarantee can put the spring back into your step. And into your home, too. Shop Blinds.com right now and save up to 45%. Up to 45% off for a limited time at Blinds.com. Blinds.com. Rules and restrictions may apply.